This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's not often a government report is handed down on a Sunday in the middle of an official long weekend, or that politicians around the state might be hitting refresh on the state treasurer's website all evening. But that's just what happened last night as environmental activists and state officials awaited the hotly anticipated report from Treasurer Beth Pierce's office, offering a suggestion for raising $1.3 billion for waterways restoration over 20 years. And Pierce delivered, posting the report well before the midnight deadline, giving interested looky-loos plenty of time before bed to pore over the 92-page document. We're going to spare you that task and spend the next half hour talking through what's in the report and how Treasurer Pierce thinks the state can come up with that money. Beth Pierce, nice to have you here today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by someone else who was integral to this process. Alyssa Shuren is former Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. She has been hard at work on this report as well, working weekends, making sure that all of the numbers fit. Welcome back to the program to you as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So $1.3 billion is the amount of new revenue that the state has said is needed over 20 years to clean up waterways in Vermont. Can you first explain, Treasurer Pierce, how that number was come up with?
Certainly. Well, that number was developed working with all of the stakeholders in the various agencies, Agency of Agriculture, Agency of Transportation, Agency of Natural Resources, the Tax Department, working all together with other stakeholders and bringing them in, municipalities, to talk about their cost as well. Talked with folks that are agriculture experts on the cost of the new regulations with farming. This is an all-in number, and I think that's very important. The cost overall was determined over a 20-year period to be $2.3 billion. Existing revenue sources were about $1.06 billion, leaving a gap of just about $1.25 billion. Now, I need to be very clear that that is an all-in. That isn't the cost to the state. That is the cost that if we did nothing, that would be borne by farmers, by developers, by municipalities for the new regulations and the issues around enforcement of our clean water requirements. The state is looking to say, how much can we help in that process, and how can we assist in that process and relieve some of that? And we targeted a number for the purposes of this report of about $25 million.
Per year. For 25 years. So in the actual report you're looking at, I think it's $970 million total, right? Which is different than the $1.25 or $1.3 right. million. Where's the discrepancy?
Certainly. Well, there are two pieces to the cost. We divided into what we call Tier 1 and Tier 2 costs. Tier 1 costs are the requirements to absolutely needed to comply with the EPA requirements and the state's regulatory process. That was about $82.2 million per year. The existing revenues are about 33.7, leaving a gap of about 48.5 million. Multiply that times 20, that's $970 million.
So this basically, for people who haven't been following the ins and outs of this, this is money that has to be found one way or another. This is basically money that is required by the EPA or cleanup that's required by the EPA that has to be funded one way or another. And it was your job and your office's job to find a suggestion for how to come up with that money. That's basically what you've been doing here.
Certainly. Well, one of the issues was that over the past several years, they've looked at this issue. There were two prior reports, a report that was done with respect to Act 138 and another report on the Clean Water Initiative. There were still questions. They asked the Treasurer's Office to be involved in that. And the mandate that we had was to take a look at the potential revenue sources, work with the Tax Department and others to quantify those, what is the estimated amount of revenue to be generated by each source, talk about recommendations to incentivize best practices. And that was very important to us because the original costs were higher, and we've been able to drive them down. And we hope by incentivizing best practices going through the entire plan that we can drive the costs down even further. An assessment of our bonding authority and whether that was appropriate, and legislative proposals to implement these. And if you look at those 90 pages of report, I think we've covered all those issues.
Riparian buffers, impervious surfaces, waterways conservation, not something that the state treasurer normally has to be an expert in. Is that where Alyssa Shuren came in here?
Absolutely. We worked very closely with our partners over at DEC. Alyssa is now working with the Treasurer's Office as the expert on those issues. I've learned an incredible amount, and I want to thank Alyssa for that and being patient with me as we're going through these processes.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This has been a great partnership, and we couldn't have gotten a report like this without working with the Treasurer's Office, so thank you for that.
So, Alyssa Shuren, what did you think coming into this would be the most important way to try to frame how the state should come up with this money and why it was important to pay it?
Well, we know that Vermonters love our waters. I mean, whether it's for swimming, fishing, drinking, you know, 40% of the state actually gets their drinking water from surface waters. So we know why we need to do this. And with the recent regulatory frameworks put in place through the Lake Champlain TMDL, which is the targets the federal government sets for the state.
Sometimes people describe it as a pollution budget.
Yeah, it is a good way to describe it, a phosphorus pollution budget, because the fact is that every time it rains in Vermont, we live in a rural state, water runs across the land and picks up harmful, pollution like and then will nutrients or sediment. Nutrients sound good, but actually there can be too much of it, and then it can cause blue-green algae blooms in the waters. And so our charge overall from a regulatory perspective is to make sure that every time it does rain that our waters don't feel it in the way they do now, that we don't have all that runoff draining into them. And that costs a lot of money to change the way we, you know, live and work on the land to make sure that the water is absorbed into the ground where it hits and isn't running into our waters. And so, we wanted to take an all-in approach when we considered this, which is why we did a process with over 23 different stakeholder meetings with over 1,000 people. And so it was a pretty robust process. We generated through that process 64 different revenue ideas. And then it was Treasurer Pierce's job with the tax department to really vet those ideas and consider what kind of framework should we put in place to get to the answer that would answer the legislators, the legislative charge.
We're talking today about not just Lake Champlain cleanup, but waterways cleanup in general. Of course, Lake Champlain, a really big part of that. And the State Treasurer's Office has just released a report detailing how we might fund this billion-dollar bill over the next 20 years. Listeners, I'd love to know what you want to know from Treasurer Pierce and former Environmental Conservation Chief Alyssa Shuren. And if you have read the report, great. If you haven't read the report, though, we're going to go through some of the things that are included in it. Primarily, how do we get to this price that the state might contribute, about $25 million a year? Where is that going to come from, at least according to these suggestions? Our number, 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So you found that some of the money for cleanup is what you're calling Tier 1. And this is primary money that needs to go to be spent on cleanup programs and conservation programs to preserve the water quality in Vermont. And Tier 2 would basically be things that would increase efficiency or that would augment and also be important for water cleanup, but not a requirement or not quite as important as Tier 1 or quite as crucial in terms of the state funding.
They would incentivize, and we think that that's important because over time, incentivizing best practices will lower the cost. And as a treasurer, that's something that's very important to me. Now, we talked a little bit about the environmental impacts. Let's talk about the money side of that a little bit. Tourism is a $2.5 billion industry in Vermont, and people connect with our resources across the state. And I do want to point out that there are more than one TMDL. There are three TMDLs that are impact 94% of the state. So it's not one area of the state. This is a statewide effort. And the one area that isn't connected with that has some PFOA problems. So we're all in on this. It's important to recognize that it is an asset. And if you don't take
what
care
is our water?
Our waterways, if you don't take care of that asset and it degrades, it impacts our economy and our prosperous economic future. So for me, this is about best value to the taxpayer and looking at it from that perspective. Now, we've got a few recommendations in there that are going to take some time, and those are about developing user fees and fees that have sometimes been called parcel fees and pervious surface fees. There's various ways that you can do this in creating and incentivizing local decision-making around stormwater utilities. That's the long-term plan, and I think it's a good one. We also have mentioned in there that we think that that going forward, that our waterways should be seen as a capital asset and incorporated in the state's long-term capital plans and monies allocated in that process. And I think that that's important, again, to see that this is an water quality. Our rivers and our lakes is infrastructure to the state.
I hear you putting the hard sell on this, Treasurer Pierce, and part of that I wonder if it's because what is included in this report may be hard to swallow for some people. So you're saying our waterways are an asset, and as we've talked about, this is money that has to be spent. The EPA has said you need to make this cleanup happen. So here's the money that we need to come up with, but the lump in people's throat is going to be about how we come up with it. And so just to summarize here, what you're looking at is about $25 million a year that the state will come up with, sort of centralized pool of money for this waterway cleanup. Right. This is your recommendation. None of this has been implemented. That's the legislature's task.
Yes.
And then, but it's about $50 million a year, a little bit less than that, that you think will be the total cost of this cleanup. So $25 million the state should come up with, and about $23.5 million that will be from private entities. So maybe a farmer who needs to put in buffers to prevent phosphorus runoff from going from the farm into the waterways, or the large parking lot owner who may need to come up with ways to make sure that there's more drainage in that impervious surface. So that's some of the private money. But the public money, this $25 million a year, this is what people are going to be fighting over. So, Alyssa Shuren, this idea that we as a state should be coming up with $25 million a year may be hard to swallow. Is it something that we just have to do one way or another? I mean, is it even in question whether or not all of the people in the state should be paying for this?
Well, the regulatory requirement exists, whether it's in one of those pollution cleanup plans that were established by the state or the federal government, or in state law through Act 64 of 2015, which is frequently called the Vermont Clean Water Act. So we need to actually comply with our clean water laws and standards that exist. And that means that we can either let the private sector and municipalities absorb the costs, the full cost, all those regulatory costs, that nearly $50 million a year, or the state can cover some of that. And Treasurer Pierce is proposing a $25 million target, 50% of those hard regulatory costs, to essentially help people comply. And that is a starting place for a conversation, but it is necessary to get the job done. And we want to just help people get there, because otherwise we know that people are struggling. We know that, milk prices are down. We know there are challenges out in the landscape. And should the state choose to do nothing, it will be really hard for those farmers, for developers, for municipalities to absorb all of these costs. And I think this is a recognition of that, the $25 million target.
In addition to that, if we choose to do nothing, what happens is if the EPA were to step in or we were out of compliance and was a lawsuit, they're going to come in with different tools than the local incentivized best practices that we're suggesting. It's going to cost us more. And for me, doing the right thing at the lowest cost is the best answer in terms of this. Now, there is a long-term plan. There is going to be pain across the board, but there's also gain in terms of that asset, and I think we need to remember that. The long-term plan does center on the concept of parcel fees and user fees.
Good. So I feel like we've buried the lead here. How are we going to pay for it? So now you're getting into it, this idea of parcel fees.
Right. So basically incentivizing local decision-making through what's called stormwater utilities, if possible. We think that will work in some parts of the state. It may be a little bit of a mix in other parts of the state.
In other words, sort of the parts of the state, regions or counties or municipalities would come up with a utility to basically figure out what to do with this money and how to collect it.
How to distribute that money and to make the best decisions in terms of where can they get the most bang for their dollar at the local level. The collection on this, there's some discussion to happen on that, but the bottom line is that it'd be a user fee that's related to the cost of fixing the pollution. So impervious surface, for instance, when, as Elisa was mentioned earlier, when water runs off of our surfaces, there's a linking that to the amount of impervious surface that you have, linking it to the amount of farm, so that we can come up with a user fee that is related to those factors. Now, that's going to take a little time to develop. And that's we think there's a 2-year horizon before we can get to that, although we need to start now. You can't wait 2 years and then be in that same spot. In the meantime, we've come up with $25 million recommendation for each year without raising taxes, without raising fees, using some of our bonded dollars, using a little bit of the existing property transfer surcharge, and using some transportation infrastructure dollars directly related to environmental issues. And we've submitted a plan to the governor's office on how to use some of those bonded dollars so that we can start this with a sizable amount of money, $25 million per year, without raising taxes, and give us that glide path to develop those local utilities.
Yeah, just to recap for people, so what you're saying is for the first 2 years of this 20-year period, this is what you're calling the glide path, would be $25 million a year that we don't have to find new sources
that
for.
That is correct.
And then after that, the next 18 years, that's when many of these recommendations would have to kick in for how we would come up with this $25 million a year. And that 2-year glide path, you're saying, would allow us to come up with these stormwater utilities and come up with sort of the rules for how to have these per parcel fees and
to make
whether
them equitable.
Mm-hmm. So yes. Whether they're charged more on people who have impervious surfaces or for land use, or whether could it be just a flat fee across the board, Alyssa Schering?
Well, one other thing I just wanted to add there is that we have additional mapping that is needed over the next 2 years to establish our parcel data and our impervious surface data. And so that's in part why we need this time frame is to finish that mapping.
So when we come back, we have a lot of listeners who have questions for the both of you about what this means, how it's going to be done. I don't know whether it's alarm or excitement. I think there's a mixture of both in this state today. And we're going to try to capture some of that and some of the questions and more details in this report. We're talking about water cleanup, waterways cleanup, and the new report issued by the Treasurer's Office last night that suggests how the state might come up with about $1 billion to pay for it. Our number, if you'd like to chime in, is 1-800-639-2211, or you can send a note to vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we are going over the details of a report released last night that offers a plan for how the state could pay for cleanup and conservation of the state's water resources over the next 20 years. It's expected to cost about $1 billion, and it's not really optional. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency requires Vermont to do this cleanup to get Lake Champlain and other waterways in better shape and to protect them for the future. What do you think about the idea of a per-parcel fee on landowners? How does the idea of the state coming up with some of the money and private entities coming up with the other big chunk sound to you? Does this plan strike the right balance? And what questions do you have for two of the authors of this new report, State Treasurer Beth Pierce and former Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, Alyssa Schurin? Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. Or you can post a comment on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And let's go now to Bill, who's calling in from Johnson. Hi, Bill. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I'm a former legislative director with Vermont Farm Bureau and was involved in debates about a per-parcel tax. You can call it a fee if you'd like, but it's a tax. And our opposition was strong, and our opposition was nearly unanimous and included forest-based industry and landowners. If it's a property tax, it's a property tax. If it calls itself a parcel fee, it's still a property tax. If you're going to raise property taxes, call them property taxes. Have the debate in the open with people who are affected by property taxes in the land-based economy. But using this per parcel fee nomenclature, it doesn't change the fact that it's a property tax. Now, if people decide that the property tax is an appropriate measure of the impact, even though most of the land-based economy is the ally in water quality protection, people like me who own a lot of river frontage, who leave it be to allow itself to be its own natural buffer, then we can disagree. But as long as you call it a per parcel fee and make it out to be anything other than a property tax, you cannot have an honest, open debate about this issue.
Bill, thanks very much for your call. Treasurer Pierce.
Well, if we were talking about a flat parcel fee, I can see part of that argument. I wouldn't agree with it entirely, but that's not what we're looking to develop. Our recommendation is to have it associated with usage and the amount of pollution that property is creating.
In other words, give it to me in a way that that I can picture. So somebody who has 1.99 acres, you know, the 2 acres and a house in the middle of a town somewhere, what are they likely to pay?
Well, a residential parcel was probably not going to have the same level as a parking lot that has a lot of flow off of its hardtop, essentially. And for us, trying to come up with measures that would allow us to do that across the state is part of this. That's why we need that 2-year. I'm not a big fan of what we call a flat parcel fee. I think it should be tied to the usage as much as possible.
Now, in other words, me and my house and my couple of acres are going to pay less than the farmer who has a lot of agricultural land and a lot of manure, and the guy who owns the big box store and has a big parking lot.
Right. That's what you're saying? That's the plan. Now, that creates more complexity, which is also part of that two-year piece to this. But let's talk about its impact if we do nothing. Right now, in 2015, the grand list in Georgia, Vermont dropped by $1.8 million due to reassessment of 37 lakeside properties with declining water quality. This is about keeping our property values up and keeping those values appropriate for folks. We need to take a look at this in that larger picture. To do nothing is going to have an adverse impact on property values. To me, it is a fee because, again, it's going to be tied to usage is the recommendation that we have. It does make it more complex. That's why we need that 2-year glide path, and that's why we're associating that glide path with a way to do it without increasing taxes.
We got a note from Alpha 16 who says, great, another tax on property owners who are already paying through the nose for Act 60. How much do these people think they can continue to take from us? To top it off, I live east of the Green Mountains. None of the water that lands on my property gets anywhere near the Lake Champlain watershed. It flows east into the Connecticut River. How long will it be before they decide to tax us to clean that up as well? Why should property owners living east of the Greens be responsible for what happens on the western side? Now, Alyssa Shuren, this isn't just about Lake Champlain.
It's not. There, 94% of the state has a cleanup plan for its waters. So whether you are in the Lake Champlain Basin, which is about half the state, all the way down to Rutland, over to Calais, all the way as far north as the state goes, or you're over in Lake Memphremagog, or you're down in the Connecticut River, you have a cleanup plan that's been set, and there's work that needs to be done. The good news is that the revenues generated, you don't only just have the regulatory burdens, you also have an ability to use some of the revenues that have been generated. So if you live in the Connecticut River Basin area, there are costs that are going to be that are being assessed and ramping up over time to make sure that you have clean waters there. And these resources, the $25 million a year, could be used in your area as well.
Let's go to Mark, who's calling in from Ferrisburg. Hi, Mark. Go right ahead.
Hello. I love your show. Happy MLK Day. And my proposal is not really a tax. You could call it a fee, too, or call it whatever you want, on all the municipal users of water, because that is where I would say the most amount of pollution and microplastics are coming from, and boats also. And, I mean, it's going to take all of us to clean up that lake, not just a couple.
Mark, thanks very much for your suggestion. Appreciate that. Let's go to James calling in from Middlebury. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi. By general agreement, conventional dairy is responsible for about 45% of the pollution in the lake, makes it the largest contributor. Act 64 imposes no material constraints on the productive capacity of the industry, no material constraints. And with the suggestion that somehow increasing the size of the vegetative buffer for conventional dairy farmers is going to clean up the lake is akin to putting drinking diet soda at the centerpiece of your plan to lose weight.
Mark, thanks for your comment. I'm going to give a chance for Treasurer Pierce to respond, but I also want to pair it with this note we got from Eric in Castleton, who says, we're being asked to underwrite the state's sacred cow, agricultural contributions, when perhaps it's time to shift to different crops. We have many individual homeowners that are being asked to be a part of this all-in strategy without having any say in how those large contributions are curtailed. I am not hearing a fair distribution so far. And Michael says, it's not right to force the rest of us in Vermont to cover the cost to rehab the lake. I would be okay to offer low-cost or even free methane digesters to the farms if we truly value small traditional dairy farming. But to just dump in the lake, let those who use the lake and make their living from it or have polluted it do the cleanup and pay for it.
A couple points. The biodigesters that we just mentioned is part of the plan. We would look to see some capital investment in biodigesters, that especially the ones that have a back end that extract nutrient recovery processes. That's very important to this. There are some public-private partnerships that could be developed around that using something called private activity bonds, which is tax-exempt financing for taxable use. So there's some alternatives that will help with that. With respect to the discussion of agriculture, and I'm the treasurer. I'm not the secretary of the Agency of Agriculture, and I don't believe it is the treasurer's job to determine the economic fate of farming and dairy farming in this state. That's a discussion between the departments that are associated with that agriculture, the General Assembly, in working through those processes. We concentrated on the mandate given to us, and I think that we've come up with something fair and equitable by tying it to use. I would also point out that the farmers have new required agricultural practices that went effect in December. Those are very important. One of the suggestions that we had in here was to actually create some assistance when you went above those. And I think that that's extraordinarily important in this mix as well.
Fair enough that the treasurer is not charged with sort of determining agricultural practices. But Alyssa Shuren, I'm sure that you have thought about this, even though, again, you are not in the Agency of Agriculture either. But as former commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, you must think about the role agriculture plays and how this is shaping part of this discussion that we're having now from activists like James.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we have had a lot of these conversations over the past few years, and every sector needs to do its part for clean water. And agriculture is the largest source of phosphorus pollution into the lake, into Lake Champlain at this point in time. And the required agricultural practices are the latest regulatory tool that just went into effect that will require the measures that we need in order to have that sector do its part. As you'll see in this report, and those required agricultural practices were also built into the accountability framework within the Lake Champlain TMDL. Just to expand there, so we have looked here, okay, how can we in this report incentivize the types of behaviors that we're hoping to achieve? How can we go above and beyond the regulatory requirement in a statewide way and get clean water for everybody? Because we know we need to get there, and the question is just how. And so I think there are some good and new ideas that were put out in this report to look at. One, just to flag, is around current use. So right now, forestry is treated a certain way in current use, and agriculture is treated a slightly different way in current use. So if you have a forest and you allow a riparian buffer to not be harvested, essentially you can remain in the current use program. But not all farms can. If you have a buffer on your farm and you let it grow up and become wooded, not all cases can that remain in current use. And so that's one example here in the report where we're saying, let's be consistent between farms and forests to make sure that they have the same benefits. And I think that's a win for farmers and a win for water quality.
Let's go to Bob calling in from Rutland. Hi, Bob. You're on.
Thank you. I wanted to ask your guest. Sadly, you mentioned about the Vermont dollars that are required by the EPA. what are the changes that are going to be coming, obviously, in the EPA in the next 4 years, to say nothing of the congressional assault on, let's say, the budget bills that gut some of the agency's ability to protect, you know, the public health and, you know, for the Clean Water Act? Thanks.
Bob, thanks for your call. You know, not only questions, well, certainly questions abound about what is likely to happen with the EPA with this change in administration at the presidential level. And new Governor Phil Scott has said he's looking to see what changes come down. Maybe there will be a little bit more flexibility or leeway in what the EPA is charging Vermont with doing and what it might cost. So what are you thinking, Treasurer Pierce?
I'm going to let Alyssa talk a little bit about this as well. But for me, this is something we need to continue to move forward on, whether or not there are changes there. It's in state statute, our clean water practices and the need to clean this up. And the bottom line for me, again, is an economic development plan. We need to maintain our efforts to clean up our waters. It's a valuable asset. I'm looking at it from the finance side.
So you're sort of saying, regardless of what might change, this is what you think the state should do, even sort of if the EPA loosened its restrictions.
Absolutely. And I'm doing that from looking at the value of an asset and the added value to the taxpayer.
And I would agree that that's really the right way to approach it, because if the EPA decides to not oversee the state efforts in the same way we have expected them to do, we'll end up in court over that. And there's going to be a lot of cost to that litigation process, because we're in a contract right now with the federal government on how we'll address water pollution in the state and, you know, through these TMDLs, these cleanup plans that we have. And we're going to need to do that. We're going to end up in court. And even if we decided we didn't want to do that, it's also what the majority of the requirements that are built into these federal and state cleanup plans are also built into state law, Act 64 of 2015, as Treasurer Pierce referenced. And so I don't see the Vermont legislature rolling back that law anytime soon. So there would need to be a lot of change on the federal and state level before we were even really having this conversation in a realistic way.
We're talking about lake cleanup, Lake Champlain cleanup, other waterways that need to be cleaned up as well, and a new report from the Treasurer's Office that suggests how the state might pay for that. Let's go to Tara, calling in from Arlington. Hi, Tara.
Hi there. What a great show today. I have a question about nonprofits. In Arlington, they're going to be building a nonprofit private dog shelter, and they have antivirals and about 2,000 gallons of water that's going into a flood zone A. Now, if you have someone like that that's really close to the headwaters and they have impervious surfaces, would a nonprofit also have to pay that fee that you're talking about?
Tara, thanks for the call. Yeah, so not just nonprofits, but tax-exempt places. Big universities sometimes have tax exemptions, or hospitals. Treasurer Pierce, what about this per-parcel fee? Would it include tax-exempt institutions as well?
I believe it would. I think this is an all-in approach. And when you see utility models that are done across the country, and this is done all over the country, and we do have examples of this in Burlington, South Burlington, Williston have utilities now. They're more around operation and maintenance. But for me, it's an all-in approach. And we all use our water resources. We all contribute in one way or another to the pollution. We need to find ways to mitigate that. And again, using this approach will hopefully mitigate behaviors with best practices to lower those costs.
Alyssa Shuren, if the state is collecting $25 million a year for waterways cleanup, what is that money actually going to be used for? But what do we get after 20 years of this?
Yeah, well, first off, hopefully we would be meeting water quality standards. That's the goal, which means we have swimmable, fishable, drinkable waters statewide. And I guess it's worth noting that as we put these investments in place, there are a lot of capital investments we're making all across the land, whether it's be on farms or developed lands or, you know, municipal properties. And then once those investments are made, we need to maintain them over time.
But what investments? What are we talking? I mean, just
yeah,
for people
so
who are
like
saying,
a wastewater treatment facility upgrade would be an example, a large parking lot retrofit to allow the water to go into the ground more quickly. On farms, maybe buffers along the edges so that you're not having the farm go right up to the edge of the waters, or cover crops, you know, to make sure that we have regenerative farming and make sure we're building soil as we move forward. A well-managed farm is one of the best things we could actually do for water quality. So these are the types of practices we'd see on the land, maybe some wetlands restoration, doing more preservation around that.
And it would be in the form of maybe grants, Treasurer Pierce, because obviously, you know, some of that is going onto private land.
The current, especially the two-year plan that we have now, we've identified actually over $80 million of ready-to-go, use the term shovel-ready projects that could be used. And some of those are capital, like wastewater treatment. Others are more preservation. And we've actually identified a way to link the two of those up at a municipal level and actually cost less for the municipality to do the wastewater treatment plant if they also combine it with a wetlands project. So there's a way to do these in best practices. There's definitely the need to do it, and we're ready to go.
Beth Pierce is Vermont State Treasurer. Alyssa Shuren is former Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. She's been working on this report as well. By the way, listeners, you can find the full report on the State Treasurer's website, and it's linked from our reporting at vpr.net. Again, these are recommendations. We will see what the legislature decides to do with this report. Beth Pierce, Alyssa Shuren, thanks very much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump has the F-35 fighter jet squarely in his sights. We'll learn what's up with cost overruns and if it's possible to put that project back out to bid now, as the president-elect seems to suggest he wants to do. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Just over 3 years ago, the Air Force made a decision. Burlington would be home to the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. This followed years of debate between those who wanted the jets and their economic boost here in Vermont and those who opposed the planes and the impact their noise could have on local communities. There's been a sort of a lull in the news regarding the F-35 for a while. That is, until President-elect Donald Trump tweeted about them in December and then brought them up in his first post-election press conference last Wednesday.
I'm very much involved with the generals and admirals on the airplane, the F-35, you've been reading about it, and it's way, way behind schedule and many, many billions of dollars over budget. I don't like that, and the admirals have been fantastic. The generals have been fantastic. I've really gotten to know them well, and we're going to do some big things on the F-35 program and perhaps the F-18 program, and we're going to get those costs way down. And we're going to get the plane to be even better, and we're going to have some competition, and it's going to be a beautiful thing.
That's President-elect Trump last week discussing the F-35 fighter jet expected to be delivered to Vermont in 2019. But as Trump mentions, there have been cost overruns and scheduling delays in the production of the fighter jet. Right now, we have NPR's national security editor Phil Ewing with us to get us up to speed on all of this. Phil, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
So Donald Trump went after the F-35 on several levels, and let's start with the budget and the schedule. How much over budget and behind schedule is this jet?
Intensely. The aircraft has about doubled in cost per jet since the first estimates when the Pentagon got this program rolling, and it hoped to have operational versions of it in the field years ago. The timetable has shifted so much that it just kind of depends on what slice of time you take. But it's safe to say that it has not gone as well or cost as little as the Defense Department originally intended. But at the same time, the Air Force and the other military services say that taxpayers are going to get what they pay for out of this program, that it will be worth the less than $400 billion to acquire these aircraft and all the delays, because they'll bring such transformational new capabilities to troops on the battlefield. Only time will tell as to whether that is true, but it has not gone the way the Pentagon hoped it would.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about what those delays are due to, what they're down to?
The Pentagon began this program as a way to try and save money, ironically. The cost of combat aircraft in the 1980s became so intense that the Defense Department rationalized that a way to do it and save money would be to get the three military services that fly fighter jets, the Army, Navy, and the Marine Corps, all to buy versions of the same one, and also to continued developing the plane even as it was being delivered in production. So if you can imagine buying a car at your dealership and you get four tires and an engine, but you don't have all the seats, you don't have a trunk, you don't have a stereo, the idea would be that you would at least have a car that you could then upgrade as you went along or continue to build as you went along. It made sense at the time, but that decision has really complicated matters in terms of fielding this aircraft because right now one comes out of the factory and it can't do all the things that they eventually hope it will be able to do, which means it needs software upgrades, it needs changes to its structure, it needs intensive testing even past the point that the Air Force and the other services hoped it would be in service. And that's what has taken so long because it's not like Apple delivering a new phone where the iPhone you get is the final product. In this case, it's the equivalent of getting a software update every couple of days just to have some of the basic functions of the phone work as advertised.
So does it still seem reasonable to think that Vermont might get the first F-35s in 2019?
At this point, the Air Force and the other services say they have got a lot of these problems under control. And so if their guesstimate is that 19 is when the first airplanes will start to arrive, I don't think there's any information to suggest otherwise. However, there's all kinds of unexpected things that have cropped up in the story of this fighter. Most recently, the fleet was grounded because a couple of airplanes had unexplained fires in the hot section of the airplane where the engine and the afterburner are. They had to ground them. They had to do an inspection. They had to figure out what was causing that. And eventually they got it fixed. But it meant that during those weeks and months when the airplanes couldn't fly, they couldn't test, they couldn't deploy, they couldn't take all the normal jobs that they had to take as part of this process. And so even though there's nothing to suggest there'll be a delay in them getting to Burlington by 2019, anything could happen between now and then, including more of those delays and updates that could stretch out the timetable.
So Donald Trump said in what we just hear him say, we're going to get those costs way down, we're going to get the plane to be even better, and we're going to have some competition. So Trump is suggesting he may bring Boeing back into the mix here. Does that seem likely that it could actually happen and maybe somebody else could be making the F-35s?
A lot of this is politics, and very little of it is about reality. But there is some historical information that's good to know here. This the F-35 airplane came out of a competition that the Pentagon ran back in the year 2000 with Boeing, and they both had a chance to build what became this fighter, and the Pentagon chose Lockheed over Boeing. And since then, Boeing has continued to produce its older model fighter aircraft, the FA-18 and the F-15 Eagle, at its factory in St. Louis, but it's never been able to break out with another next-generation airplane just because the biggest one in the world was this F-35, and part of the deal was that a lot of the other militaries around the world would be buying it, which means Boeing was cut out of those markets. What Trump has suggested is that he could force the U.S. military services to buy one of those older model airplanes that Boeing makes, specifically the FA-18 ENF Super Hornet, which is what the U.S. Navy flies today off its aircraft carriers. But the U.S. Air Force says that's not going to work because that's an old 1980s model jet, basically, and what it needs is this advanced new F-35, which has all kinds of stealth features that make it harder to detect, all kinds of integrated electronic capabilities that enable it to talk with other aircraft on the battlefield and satellites in space and all kinds of fancy gimcrack features. And the FA-18 just won't do because it doesn't have any of those.
Well, and not just us, right? But all these other militaries around the world are also trying to buy the F-35s and have put in what they want in this fighter jet?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the other reason why a lot of this is probably not going to be too dangerous to the program is if it goes away or if it's cut dramatically back, that means that most of the free world's militaries won't have an advanced new fighters. The Brits, the Italians, the South Koreans, the Japanese, European militaries, the Israelis, they're all counting on this F-35. And so if it were cut in production or it were canceled, which, again, is very unlikely, then they would be in difficult straits as well, just like the U.S. So he is trying to use the bully pulpit and use his political brand as a deal maker, as a tough negotiator, to get Lockheed to come down on the price for the next batch of aircraft that the U.S. buys. And he very likely will succeed because Lockheed Martin doesn't like us to be talking about the problems with this program. It wants us to be talking about how advanced and transformational this jet is.
Well, and we'll have to have you on next time to talk more about that. Phil Ewing is NPR's National Security Editor. Thank you very much for talking F-35s with us, Phil.
My pleasure.
All right, today is Martin Luther King Day, and we know many of you are listening while having a day off. Since 1994, MLK Day has also been a national day of service, when people are encouraged to volunteer in their communities. Around Vermont today, some of the activities we've heard about include a community lunch and discussion happening at the Unitarian Church in Montpelier. The Winooski Senior Center is holding a discussion called Beyond Martin Luther King Jr., Exploring Guilt and Racism. In Brattleboro, the School for International Training is kicking off a year-long project on racial healing tomorrow night at the Brooks Memorial Library. Tell us how you're marking this MLK Day by sending an email to vermontedition@vpr.net or post photos and stories on our Facebook page of how you volunteered or reflected on today. The idea of making the third Monday in January a day of service came from Senator Harris Wofford and Congressman John Lewis. Lewis was a civil rights activist who worked closely with Martin Luther King Jr., and in 1965 he was beaten severely in a civil rights march that began in Selma, Alabama. I mention this history because tomorrow on the program we're going to look at the purpose and impact of protest. Marches are planned in Washington and across the country this week as Donald Trump takes office, and John Lewis is back in the headlines 50 years later. We want to know about what you're doing, and we're going to talk about the long history of political protest in America, what forms it's taken, and what it can accomplish. Send your notes to vermontedition@vpr.net, and be sure to tune in for this program live tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.